The Scooby-Doo's and Don't. The Scooby-Doo's and Don't. The Scooby-Doo's and Don't. The Scooby-Doo's and Don't.
Hey guys, Scooby's feeling kind of like he's got rabies. Rabies for Scooby-Doo's and Don'ts.
Don't we all?
I'm Trish.
And I'm Siobhan.
And welcome back to the season finale of Scooby-Doo's and Don'ts.
Yes, this week we will be discussing my favourite movie of all time, Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed.
Truly the absolute pinnacle of modern cinema.
It's true. Fight Club who? I don't know her. The Matrix? Not even good compared to this. Inception? I've actually never seen it.
So before we really get into it, we just want to thank our fans for what has been an incredible reception to this podcast. We did not expect the amount of love and popularity that you've shown us, but know that we love you just as much, like so much, man.
If not more. So this movie has some very personal significance to me, not only because of the bamboo thing which I mentioned back in our very first episode, but also because my first year of being a student, I was living in student accommodation and a guy on my floor asked if I wanted to rent out the TV room with him to watch a movie and have kind of like a date sort of situation. And I said yes, but only if we watched Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed, thinking that would be the end of it. But no, he acquired Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed and we had to watch it together, and it was the most awkward date of my life, where I avoided him the whole time, sitting on beanbags on the opposite side of the room in this dark hall-like thing, watching Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed, where you could hear the rustle of the popcorn bag because we had nothing to say to each other.
I can't say that this movie carries the same amount of significance for me. The more important to my formation as a person of the two is probably Spooky Island. However, I will say that the two little skeleton dudes in this movie terrified me as a child and were my closet monster for a good 3 weeks. And seeing them in the movie today really caused a lot of distress to my inner child. I had to do a lot of self-soothing. I had to take some deep breaths, but I got through it and we're here now recording.
Exactly. I think it's like a character test to find out which of the Scooby-Doo monsters from this movie was the scariest to you as a child. Mine was the big candy floss monster. It scared the hell out of me and I have no idea why, because visually it's definitely not the scariest of the monsters.
But what it represents.
What it represents is absolutely horrific, but we don't have time to unpack that today. We are going to just jump into the summary now.
So I just want to touch on the opening scene really quickly, and that the opening scene of this film is so tonally different to the rest that I just am baffled by it still. So the film opens with kind of, you know, like this aerial swooping shot traveling through the city, and we see the dives and the soaring, and there's extremely dramatic opera music in the background. And I just think that this was a really interesting cinematic choice because it does really set you up for the absolute grandeur of this film. And I think, looking back, that perhaps this was the inspiration for Chris Nolan in The Dark Knight.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm surprised more people haven't put two and two together.
Oh no, I snorted.
Okay, so the official summary for this movie is: when Mystery Inc. are guests of honor at a grand opening of the Coolsville Museum of Criminology, a masked villain shows up and creates havoc before stealing the costumes of the gang's most notorious villains, Black Note Ghost, Pterodactyl Ghost, Tar Monster. And could it be their nemesis, mad scientist Dr. Jonathan Jacobo? He's returned and it's trying to recreate their deadliest enemy. Velma has a crush on the museum curator Patrick Wisely, despite her fears of intimacy, but why is he acting so suspicious? The mystery gang is hard-pressed to succeed this time, since annoying television reporter Heather Jasper Howell insists that they are buffoons.
So the first thing that I want to say in terms of general thoughts I have about this film is that it is noticeably less culturally appropriative than the first. I'm not sure if that's due to the urban setting, but it was a nice surprise to see. However, I do think that in terms of the gender politics of the movie, I think that there was a lot more to unpack here than in the first film.
I agree with that, absolutely. My general thoughts about this movie are kind of a bit skewed because, as I said, it is my favourite film of all times. But every time I watch it, there's a little niggling, angry gnome in my ear that's just like, I wish I could punch Fred in the face. He is the most useless member of the team, and that has not changed.
Yeah, I agree. I think Fred is particularly toxic in this movie.
There's not really a redeeming quality about him. It's the way that the narrative tries to frame it is that Daphne is the one who's struggling to find her purpose and her place in the group, when actually she has quite a defined role. Because she's physically, she's the fighter. She's smart. She's always helping Velma. She's a people person. She knows when there's something wrong with a member of the group. So what does Fred do other than say, let's split up, gang, which they probably could figure out on their own?
In fact, the one time in the movie where Shaggy says, let's split up, gang, Fred gets noticeably distressed and says, that's what I say. And the only reason someone would get that upset about the suggestion to split up is if Fred knows innately that that is his only use to the group.
Exactly. He literally doesn't do anything that couldn't be replaced by Scooby.
Exactly.
Even driving the mystery machine, we find out that Scooby is perfectly capable of filling those shoes or filling the accelerator pedal. As it were.
I think that another key thing is that many of the issues of the film actually arise from Fred's impulsive actions. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the kind of secondary antagonist of the film is Heather, who is a upstart reporter who is constantly misrepresenting the gang in the media and making them look worse than they are. But she's taking everything Fred says out of context. The other members of the gang aren't saying things which can be taken out of context. And this makes Fred visibly angry in that he feels like he's constantly being misquoted or misrepresented, and to a degree that is true. But it's also true that Fred is constantly mishearing or misunderstanding other people as well. So when he receives the same treatment, he responds in a very aggressive manner.
Exactly. And Daphne herself says, are you sure you want to face the reporters right now? Because usually we'll do it after we've solved the case. And Fred completely undermines and ignores her and just says, oh, don't worry about it, sweetheart. It's fine. And it's not fine. And I have a tally chart that I was keeping during this movie of all the times that Fred ignored someone's very fair and helpful advice and it ended in consequences for the whole gang. It was 3 times. That's 3 too many.
And there are several points in the film where either Velma or Daphne approach Fred to open up emotionally or seek his advice, and Fred just completely blows them off. As Shiv mentioned earlier, one of the parts of Daphne's character arc is that she's trying to assert her place in the gang and figure out where she belongs. And she asks Fred, you know, am I just a pretty face? And Fred's response is, no, I mean, yes, I mean, not fat. Definitely not fat. Is this sort of what you're looking for? And it's not what Daphne is looking for at all, and then puts an entirely new insecurity into her head, which is terrible.
It is. And assuming Fred's role in the group is the leader, as Heather says, isn't the leader's job supposed to be working with the people in the group and supporting them? But he's shown himself to be completely incapable of doing that.
And Fred's only growth, and I use that term extremely liberally in the film, is brought about because Daphne is his external processor. There's several points in the film where Daphne tries to approach Fred and is like, I'm observing that you're feeling really unhappy right now. Do you want to talk about it? And Fred brushes her off and says that talking is for wimps. And then later in the film, when Fred is jousting the Black Knight monster and gets knocked from his motorbike and is lying incapacitated on the ground, and Daphne, who has been fighting the 10,000 volt monster, is also incapacitated on the ground, noting the significant difference between fighting a Black Knight and electricity itself. Fred finally acknowledges to Daphne that he is afraid. And then the Black Knight comes over and says, oh, talking is for wimps. And Fred says, I can see past that macho facade. And it's like, Fred, you, this is your facade. This is you. You are the one wearing the mask after all throughout this film. So for him to then turn around and instantly try and do it to someone else feels quite hypocritical to me, as opposed to being a sign of genuine growth.
Mm.
Again, if your growth is coming about because someone else has put a huge amount of emotional labor into you, then that's not really growth, because what are you going to do when that person isn't around to hold your hand through your emotional journey anymore?
Exactly. And eventually that person, Daphne in this case, is going to have to process their own emotions, especially if they're doing all this hand-holding all the time of Fred. And what is Fred just going to go back on all of that after she needs her own space? What Fred needs is a therapist. He needs to go and do some cognitive behavioral therapy or something.
The only thing that I appreciate about Fred at this point is the dedication to ascots, and that he always seems to have one on hand or around his neck towards the kind of final act where the gang has found the lair at which Mr. I'm sorry, he has a PhD. Dr. Jacoby is creating all these monsters, and Fred is jousting this Dark Knight, as I've mentioned. And it's such a male fantasy type of scene. And that Fred lifts off this old rag to find a beautiful gleaming motorcycle beneath, and a helmet conveniently next to it as well. And he ties the ascot around his neck before he goes to joust the Black Knight with a really long pipe that he also conveniently found. And the scene, I understand that it's supposed to make Fred look heroic, but all it made me think is that Fred needs to be constantly posturing and constantly becoming something which is not himself in order to face issues. Whereas Daphne, in comparison, when she fights the 10,000 volt monster, all Daphne has is herself.
Fred is not known to be the fighter. That's Daphne.
Another point which I just want to touch on is that to a degree, Daphne actually figures out who the villain of the film is less than halfway through the movie.
Oh yeah.
And that she confronts Heather after Heather interviews Fred for the second time after Fred has been specifically told by Daphne to not do that, and says, why are you doing this? We're trying to talk girl to girl. And even though there's a red herring thrown in that the reporter's cameraman then goes to the top of the museum and does his whole big scary silver mask, angry villain speech with a reporter standing there, we do see that Daphne has very quickly figured out that there is something wrong here and that the reporter is somehow involved in the mystery.
Mm-hmm. And nobody else picked up on that. That was just Daphne immediately had that instinct.
And Daphne is just consistently gaslighted throughout this film, but she continues to give her all to the gang anyway. I think another part of the characterization of the gang, which I want to touch on as well, is the really interesting dichotomy we have, where we have this forced heteronormativity of Velma, while also this very strong undercurrent of homoeroticism between Velma and Daphne.
I agree, and I think that those two things, to a degree, can coexist, because it's quite possible that Velma is suffering from compulsive heterosexuality. Of course, she is not a real person, she's been written this way, so it's the writer's fault, but the chemistry in the movie is definitely between Daphne and Velma. Patrick is nothing. Patrick is just this little museum man, and when Velma is like trying to reject him because she's afraid of intimacy or whatever they try to sell us, she says, I can't be with you because my mistress is mystery and I must heed her sweet call. And I would just like to point out that she automatically uses the female pronoun to describe mystery, which in this instance is in place of a romantic relationship, because deep down she knows that she wants to be with a woman, and that is Daphne.
Where Patrick asks her out properly for the first time, and Velma kind of runs away and is like crawling underneath the table, and Daphne goes after her. And it's a scene filled with so much sexual tension. But even I was able to pick up on that. You know, like, you see them kind of, like, crawling around, and then they come together, and the last thing that Velma says is, you know, like, I don't know if I can be intimate with another person. And she says it when Daphne is just a hand width away from her face, and it's a very intimate moment. I appreciate that, James Gunn was trying to do, you know, like a nod, wink, wink here about Velma. But again, like we said in the last episode when we were talking about Spooky Island, that's just not enough, especially when you're throwing in this red herring male character here. Are we seriously supposed to believe that Seth Green is a legitimate love interest for anyone?
Only in a scary movie like Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed. But that's the thing as well. It is a wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing. They're inches apart. Their noses are nearly touching. But the male love interest was not necessary because he did the opposite. He went in the other direction for no reason, just to give Velma the illusion of heterosexuality.
And I think that there are some quite significant issues with the way in which Patrick, Velma's male love interest, was handled in general. And that, I'm not going to lie, there are a number of plot holes in this film. Enough to make a Swiss cheese monster. But I think the biggest is what this man's intentions truly are. Perhaps he is the villain, because he keeps showing up conveniently at weird times doing really suspicious villainy-like things. So, for example, there's a pub called The Faux Ghost. Great name, by the way. That Shaggy and Scooby are at. And Patrick is there acting incredibly suspicious. At multiple other points in the film, he just shows up unannounced, and it's not really clear why he is also trying to investigate on his own. He's a museum curator.
Not only were his motivations very ambiguous, but as a character, it was hard to root for him when he seemed to have this kind of untapped aggression to him. He was like a little chihuahua. He was just so full of rage. Anytime something went wrong, his automatic response was to get aggressive about it. Even to Velma, who was his love interest, he's immediately just angrily brushing her off as if it's her fault.
There are also a number of questions that I had after this film ended raised about this character. So why is he constantly showing up where the bad guys are if he's not a bad guy? Because another point is that Velma finds this shrine to Dr.
Jacobo.
And why would Dr. Jacobo make a shrine to himself? Someone else must have put the shrine there, because that's just a whole nother level of bizarre behavior.
Wasn't it also implied that that photo she was holding up had Patrick as a child in it?
Yes, Dr. Jacobo was standing next to a little short ginger kid at the front of a science classroom. So who is that kid, and why was that scene even included if Patrick isn't somehow also supposed to be evil? Another thing that I want to touch on as well is that later in the movie, towards leading up to the final battle, Velma is trying to get away from Patrick after she's been confronted by him in the creepy shrine room, and she's going across this metal bridge and she slips and loses her footing and is hanging on to the grate for dear life, and Patrick catches her and is holding her with the other hand and says, "You need to trust me to pull you up." And Velma says, "Well, all the facts are pointing towards you being the villain. I don't trust you." And he says, "What does your heart say?" And eventually she allows him to pull her up, and then once he has her up on the ground, he immediately tries to push her back over the bridge. And yes, you could make an argument that the reason he does that is because one of the pterodactyl monsters is swooping in and does grab Patrick and fly off with him to an undetermined location. However, he knows that if she falls off that bridge, she would die. Mm-hmm. So why does he push her to a certain death to get her out of the way of the pterodactyl monster?
That is a good point, because another way that you could read that whole scene is that the pterodactyl ghost is taking him away because he's working with it, and it's just his mode of transportation. He's just pushing her down. And if the writers intended for him to be a legitimate love interest, they probably should have plotted that scene out better.
Particularly when we see the Silver Mask antagonist, who later turns out to be Dr. Jacobi, regularly uses the pterodactyl for transportation.
Exactly. I think that Patrick is a suspicious character. If there had been a third movie, which tragically there was not, I would have liked to see Patrick be the villain.
Although we would have then had to be confronted with Velma being in an unhappy heterosexual relationship, which I just don't see being feasible in this franchise, or indeed in the Scooby-Doo universe at large.
They don't even kiss in the whole film. They don't hold hands. There's nothing, there's no chemistry or tension between them at all.
One final thing that I do want to actually loop back to as well about Velma that you've just reminded me of is that each member of the gang has their own dedicated fan club. And Velma's is called the Dinkley Brigade, which is incredible. However, I'd like to note that, and I do think that this is extremely strong evidence that Velma is intended to be gay, as she should be, is that in the credits, the Dinkley Brigade actresses are referred to as the mullet nerdettes.
And if that is not a euphemism for lesbian, I don't know what is.
Exactly.
I really wanted to get a quiz team together and call them the Dinkley Brigade, but every time I brought this up to anyone, they were not interested in this name. It's so funny, but apparently it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah. I think the last thing to touch on in terms of the gang is Shaggy and Scooby in this movie. So we've spoken in the past that there is an incredibly sinister energy that tends to surround Scooby, particularly in The Mystery Begins and Curse of the Lake Monster. He seems like a malevolent cryptid.
Yeah.
However, in this film, we see that completely switched around, and Scooby is incredibly pure.
He is so innocent and kind. He has the energy of a dog that talks. And I think that when we strayed from that, we strayed from God's light.
We really did. This is the only film where I could genuinely believe that Scooby is a pure soul. One example of that, which I think is the cutest thing, when Shaggy and Scooby decide that they need to become legitimate detectives, which is meant to be their character arc for the overall film, they're trying to posture themselves as being of equal intellect to Fred, Daphne, and Velma. Scooby turns when asked for what his conclusion on one of the clues is. He holds up a little drawing and says, "Funny."
It's adorable.
And I think this is the only film that we've seen so far which actually does capture Scooby's innocent and goofy spirit. Another thing that I'd like to point out as well is that in the final scene of the movie, it's Scooby that saves the gang, which is, again, like just a really nice touch. However, when the rest of the gang is being incapacitated by this tar monster and Scooby is cornered and he whimpers to members of the gang, but he does not whimper to Fred. Doesn't refer to Fred at all.
Fred does not get any call out from Scooby when he is afraid.
Now, I do want to say that we should probably walk this back a little bit. He has blood on his paws in this film. Shaggy and Scooby eat the candy floss monster. However, Scooby also shatters the tar monster, which means that Scooby in this film is a murderer. We already have established that Scooby is impervious to physics and is not confined to the same laws of gravity or mass or really anything that the rest of us are held accountable to. However, in the very final battle, Scooby is moving in slow motion towards the control panel, which they need to be using in order to reverse the monster-making process, and he's doing it in slow motion. And then we see that everything else around him is moving at regular speed. So what that means is that not only is Scooby impervious to physics, but also time itself.
Scooby is much more powerful than he is given credit for.
He really is. He can also drive and read.
Yeah, I'm unsure whether Shaggy can read, though.
It's never really made clear in this film whether it's actually possible.
That's why I don't like when, in the certain incarnations, when Scooby is portrayed as Shaggy's pet. Because they aren't. They're at a very similar intelligence level. They're friends. They're not pet and owner.
They are brothers in arms.
They're colleagues.
Co-workers. I think as well, one more thing that I really want to quickly touch on is that when Shaggy and Scooby travel in costume to the faux ghost in order to search for clues, there's a scene where Scooby-Doo is dancing to funky, groovy music in a glittery, deep-cut jumpsuit, which is the exact same design as the one that Velma wears in order to supposedly seduce Patrick. Referring back to our horoscope episode, that is the exact kind of impulsive, attention-seeking behaviour that I'd expect from an Aries.
You just keep slandering different signs. You're going to get all of them by the end of this.
I'm just collecting them all.
You gotta catch them all.
Yeah. Don't say that. That's a copyrighted phrase and we're not monetized. Okay. So having covered now the various dynamics within the gang and the character arcs that the characters go over, there's one more character that I want to touch on, and that is the poor, hideous old man, Wiggles. For a minute,
I thought you might be going to mention the fact that Ruben Studdard is credited as himself in this movie, so technically a character that exists in the Scooby-Doo universe, but let's talk about this one first.
Ruben is also the only name that we can ever hear Scooby-Doo say perfectly.
I went on 3 dates with a guy called Ruben, and on our last ever date, I said to him, haha, like Ruben the road safety bear. And then he texted me and dumped me straight away afterwards. But let's talk about Jacobo now.
Old Man Wickles. Old Man Wickles is the ultimate red herring in the first act of the film, in that he is Dr. Jacoby's cellmate. And when Dr. Jacoby has been presumed dead for most of the film due to him trying to make an escape using a makeshift pterodactyl wing costume, they go to Old Man Wickles' house and they find things like a book on how to create monsters. The Black Knight ghost is there. There's just a lot of evidence stacking up against Old Man Wickles, which is part of the reason why Shaggy and Scooby followed him to the faux ghost. However, what Old Man Wickles is actually trying to do is far more insidious than releasing monsters upon the innocent town of Coolsville. And that is a child labor camp.
It is. It's literally a mining camp where you can send your kids on this beautiful, authentic mining experience where they have to mine for 9 hours a day, did he say?
Yeah. Because there's a scene where they come across this dilapidated set, which later turns out to be the actual lair where they are building the monsters, to the gang's credit. And Old Man Wickles is having a very serious conversation with a group of people who later turn out to be his investors. And he's telling them all about these details of this child labor camp where they'll mine for 8 hours a day. And it's called the Old Time Mining Camp.
And it's just wild.
I'm not sure why it was chosen to be included, but I'm glad that it was, because again, we see yet another hint towards the insidiousness of capitalism in Scooby-Doo. A mining camp being one of the main sets for this film seems particularly appropriate, considering that one of the key causes of tension in this film is Fred consistently digging himself deeper into holes.
That is a very good point. Also, I wonder if it was intentional that the miners would be miners, because they're underage.
Oh my god, I never even thought of that. That's so clever.
I know.
James Crunn will give you some credit where credit is due. However, I do think that if Craig Titley had been attached to this project as well, as he was the co-writer for Jameson on Spooky Island, we would not have seen as many plot holes as we do in this movie.
No, I think Craig was there to hold James accountable.
Yeah. Turning now to ratings. I suspect that I already know your answer, but how many jinkies would you give this film?
I'm in two minds. So, on one hand, 3 million out of 5. But on the other hand, my official answer, 4 out of 5. I'm taking away a jinkie for the forced heterosexual relationship that Velma should not be subjected to with an angry gnome man who is Seth Green.
Yes.
What are your ratings, your jinkies on this?
Well, I get to tally of how many times Daphne saves the gang from themselves, and that happened 4 times in this movie. So I am also going to give this movie 4 jinkies out of 5. And I agree that the forced heteronormativity of this film does definitely detract. However, I think the key reason why I'm taking away a jinky is the scene where Shaggy and Scooby are drinking potions out of a fridge, which is generally ill-advised behaviour. However, Scooby turns into this alien slug creature, and that scene shook me to my core then, and it shook me to my core now. And I don't think that any movie that includes a scene where you see Scooby-Doo as a sticky, slimy, green slug monster can ever be truly perfect.
I can't believe it. This is the first time in our entire season we've been at the same rating.
Exactly.
How does it feel?
It feels great. I don't feel like such a bitch anymore.
The funny thing is, I'm the bitch. I'm always saying all this horrible stuff about the characters, and then at the end I'll be like, oh, but I'll give it 5 out of 5 jinkies. As if I haven't just gone and said all this horrible stuff before.
It's okay. I think that you're just a naturally forgiving person. So, Jinkies Junkies, we are now at the end of season one, but don't fear, because we will definitely be back with season two very soon. And in the meantime, you can keep up with what we're doing on Instagram at Scooby-Doos and Don'ts, and now on TikTok at Scooby-Doos and Don'ts.
Yeah, so get excited for season two, and we will see you there. Have a sustainable 2 weeks.
Goodbye.